This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with a show crammed with science that matters. Three new papers on climate change, rising emissions from our food system, seas rising 5 meters over 16 feet in a single century, and the big bang of a meteor strike. Let's go. The more scientists look, the impacts of overpopulation are impossible. A new study from the University of Washington projects the world population by the year 2100 will be 11 billion people, 2 billion higher than figures accepted by the United Nations. Even if it's 9 billion people, a study out of Cambridge University calculates the greenhouse gases just to feed that population will swallow our entire budget for greenhouse gases. On our current path, we can feed the people of the world, but transportation, manufacturing, and all the other things we do would have to be carbon-free. There are some solutions, so I've contacted the study's lead author, Boyana Baja. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you.
Before we delve into the high-carbon future of agriculture, please tell us the title of your study and where it's published.
All right, sure. I think it's called The Importance of Food Demand Management for Climate Mitigation, and it has been published in Nature Climate Change Journal.
Thank you. Well, I know in the Middle Ages of Europe, when there was a burst of population growth, people cut down forests to plant crops. Is that going to happen again, or is it already happening?
It's definitely happening and has been happening, basically, probably ever since. But, you know, to various degrees. So at the moment in North American regions, in Europe, and parts of Asia, that's not the case anymore. So we actually produce enough food, the crop yields are high enough, and we're actually abandoning some of the more marginal cropland areas and agricultural areas. But in the tropical zones, so where actually more poor countries are located, we still see quite a lot of deforestation to make space for more agriculture. I'm sure you've all heard of Amazon deforestation and so on, which is largely now being, I mean, areas that are deforested are largely used for cattle ranching or for growing seed crops for cattle. And similar things are happening in Southeast Asia, where we also see an increase in oil palm plantations in the deforested area and in Africa as well. So it's still happening, just in different places.
So when we burn or cut forests, my understanding is that we lose the carbon twice, really. The trees themselves are made out of carbon. That's released to the air. But forests also buffer some of our carbon pollution, and we lose that too. Could you talk to us a bit more about the relationship between forests and agriculture?
For sure. So it's a bit like you said. We lose carbon that's in the forest, and forests have higher capacity of storing carbon than just the cropland does, not just the trees themselves, but also the soils. And then also, well, there has been recently some sort of trends that forests have been increasing in carbon biomass and growing better and better. But that's minor, sort of, that would be the ongoing carbon sequestration that you mentioned, but that's minor compared to just the storage and the impact of losing that storage. And yeah, so basically, when the agriculture expands, basically forests are cleared. Now, it doesn't matter which way they're cleared, because if they're just burned, that makes it worse than if, for example, the trees are logged and then maybe used in construction or somewhere else and where that carbon is stored for a bit longer. So there are some sort of nuances and details there, but that's the basic relationship.
Did your study look at how much forest we might lose by mid-century?
Well, yeah, that was part of the indicators that we looked at. I would have to look up exactly what the numbers were.
I think it was 10% more than what we've already lost.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Well, okay, now that leads to my really big question is there enough extra land left on this planet to feed 9 or more billion people? And if so, where is that?
There is. So there would be enough land, per se. The problem is, what are the impacts of using more and more of this land for agriculture, as opposed to leaving some land for biodiversity, for other ecosystem services, and also for carbon sequestration. So, you know, there is land, it's just there are actually many alternative uses for it, so we should try and avoid using it for producing food that perhaps could be produced in a more efficient way.
Well, yeah, we could turn the planet into one big farm, but it'd be pretty lonely. All the other animals that are already living there would go extinct, I presume.
Yes, exactly. I think that type of agricultural deforestation is also number one cause of losing biodiversity. Plus, if we did do that, we'd probably be facing with such strong climate change. We wouldn't just be lonely, but we would be dealing with some quite weird climate as well.
I notice you predict a big jump in fertilizer use. Is that just because there's more land being farmed, or is it because humans will move into less productive soils to do that farming?
Yeah, it's a combination of both, I believe. But yeah, it's mostly to do with the fact that there will be more food needing to produce. So therefore, if you go for higher yields and less land or more land that needs fertilizer, in both cases, you do need some more fertilizer. Although the efficiencies are improving, so that helps a bit, but maybe not quite as much as would need to completely reduce the increases or remove the need for increases.
All right. Now, we then have the separate problem of a worldwide switch to meat consumption, and I think it is almost a separate issue from just raw population expansion. Why is meat a problem?
It's a problem because of two things. First thing is that livestock produces methane emission, especially ruminants, so cattle, goats, and sheep, but also chicken and pigs, only that they only produce it through manure, not necessarily directly through digestion. So that's one problem. The second problem is that we also need to grow a lot of feed for those animals to then get not that many calories out. So calories in feed are a lot higher than calories we get from meat or from other livestock products as well. So from dairy, it's quite similar. So in the same way, if I want to increase my meat consumption, then we'd need a lot more land than if I just wanted to eat more lentils or more grain.
What are the yield gaps that you talk about?
So these are the gaps between the yields that are currently achieved in best practice agriculture, mostly in more richer developed countries where good technology and good information is available, compared to the yields that are achieved in less developed countries or just less well-managed agricultural land, which can be up to 5 times lower, let's say, than what we would expect from those local conditions. So it does matter, you know, we do take into consideration what kind of soil there is, what kind of rain or temperature. But considering those, we should, for example, in some places, we would expect that the yields would be higher. Also, they would be higher if they had the access to the technology that best practice agriculture does. So that includes fertilizers and maybe some pesticides and so on.
And I've seen various studies about food waste, which you also talk about. And as I recall, even in a hungry country like India, about half the crops grown are lost to pests, lack of refrigeration, poor transport, uneven distribution. Is food waste just a problem in developing countries?
No, it's almost the opposite. It's equally so or even more the problem in the developed countries, except that it happens at a different stage. So like you said, in poorer country, it might be the lack of proper storage or transportation. With us, it's more at consumer stage. So we waste quite an awful lot of what we've already bought. And then we, you know, let it go out of date and threw it away, or we cook too much and then threw it away. or maybe supermarkets throw it away. So it's in a different place in sort of food supply chain, but it's equally in size, if not even higher.
You know, when we study the use of oil, we look at the price of it as one of the things that determines how much will be used. And I'm thinking it must be the same with food. I expect food prices to go up for a number of reasons. Did you include different food prices in your study scenarios?
No, we didn't. We only looked at food demand projections as given by UN Food and Agriculture Organization. And I guess Dave already must have some sort of background consideration about what food prices might, how they might change in the future or how they might fluctuate. But we just use that already as a given.
This is Radio EcoShock. A new paper suggests food production may use up all our carbon budget by 2050, leaving nothing for the rest of human use like manufacturing or transportation. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is from Cambridge University. Okay, let's take our business as usual scenario, going the way we are now. What are the emission figures expected by 2050 to feed the human world?
Well, yeah, what we did was we looked at these projections of food demand for the future and then projections for yield increases as they are based on the current trends in yields. These two studies were both done by some other research organizations, and we kind of matched the two and seen how much more agricultural land does the mismatch between the two require. And then we quantify the greenhouse gas emissions from the land use change that would happen as a result, as well as the greenhouse gas emissions from all the livestock, oil, the fertilizer use, and the mechanization use, so tractors and so on. And we found out that in this kind of business as usual scenario, they would go up by about 80% based on 2009 emissions from the same sources.
All right. And that ends up being as much as we're allowed to burn in some carbon budget. What is that carbon budget for 2050? Where did you get that budget from?
So, yes, we compared the carbon budget, which, again, you know, were done by other sort of scientists. And they've looked at what kind of greenhouse gas emissions we could still emit in 2050 to fall below the dangerous 2-degree climate warming.
You know, personally, it looks like we're already way over budget right now in 2014. I have a hard time believing we'll be able to burn any carbon at all in 2050 and still have a climate that we can inhabit. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think we'll still be burning carbon in 2050, or will we actually have to have a civilization that draws carbon down out of the atmosphere?
I believe that these carbon budgets have some weight to them, and the people that came up with them probably, you know, thought this through. So, for example, today we are at 50 million CO2 equivalents, and that carbon budget that I just mentioned was about 20 or 22. So we would need to decrease quite a lot from where we are today. And I think there are some low-hanging fruits where we can reduce carbon emissions quite quickly and in a way that doesn't necessarily harm our well-being and people's comforts. And actually, you know, reducing food waste, for example, is one of such low-hanging fruits. I don't see how, for example, halving the food waste, which would have quite a big impact on reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, would really harm anyone. And there are other things like that. And I think in energy, there are many technological solutions to produce energy in sustainable ways. So I'm hoping that all of those will be fully used by 2050. And yes, in the food sort of section, I hope, like I said, that we do wake up and reduce food waste. And also, unfortunately, there isn't any parallel in the food sector from decarbonization of energy. So you can decarbonize power plant or electricity supply. You can think of wind farm or solar. But I can't really think of the way you could stop cows from producing methane apart from maybe having less of them.
I've seen a weird gadget that you put on the cow that tries to collect some of the methane, but that's never going to happen with the over a billion cows on the planet.
Exactly, yes. It seems there might be some technological fixes, but it seems unlikely that, you know, they could cover the scales at which livestock farming is at the moment.
And we're going to keep eating. We know that. So you do propose in your paper one big move that we could do to reduce carbon emissions, and that is by reducing meat consumption. But, you know, let's be honest, we're a long way from being vegetarians. Most people I know still base their dinner table as meat as the star attraction. What is happening in the developing world where there used to be a substantial population who ate mainly vegetables and meat very rarely? What's happening now in that trend?
Yeah, so there are several trends, and there are huge regional differences. So one encouraging trend is that actually in Europe and in US and probably Canada as well, there is a very, very small but still a decrease in per capita beef consumption in very recent years. So that's a positive trend. But there is an increase in all other livestock products, so dairy, pork, poultry, are all increasing. Mind you, beef does have the highest impact per unit, so there's still a little trade-off there, at least. In China, there has been a big increase in meat consumption, especially of pork and poultry. So I think that is probably stabilizing now. In, for example, India, there hasn't been. Even though the population got a lot richer, they've sort of kept more to their traditional diet. And we haven't seen, at least not at the same scales as it happened in Europe before and in America before and in China. We haven't seen the same trend in India. So it varies around a lot. But I'm hoping that as people increasingly are aware of not only environmental implications, but also health implications of exaggerated meat consumption, I think balanced meat consumption is probably okay. But I think, you know, more and more people are hopefully going to curb their meat consumption a bit, and dairy as well, so both of them.
Well, I'm going to ask you a bit of a strange question. Did you include a scenario where the population did not reach 9 billion, but actually fell to less than 7 billion, perhaps due to a massive plague? And that seems like a fair question as Ebola tries to escape from West Africa. If we're going to, you know, consider all scenarios, maybe we won't expand our population.
Well, I'm definitely hoping that nothing like that happens. I'm not that worried about population as I think you are, Alex, because in a way it is stabilizing already, I believe. There is some really good research I've seen by Dr. Hans Rosling when he explains how basically we are on a trajectory to reach 10 billion, but we might actually not go that much far over it, especially if we focus a lot on female education in poor countries, for example. So we did do some sensitivity analysis around population. And yes, if population is lower, then all the impacts from agriculture on the environment are also lower. If it's higher than the 9.6 billion that we assumed as a medium, then the impacts are higher. But I think more than just population, it's the per capita consumption that's driving the most impacts.
You mentioned a study by Dr. Hans, and I missed the last name. Would you mind spelling that last name for me so I can look it up?
Yeah, so it's Rosling.
Okay. I'll put a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.info. You know, the real stunning thing is the need that you had to do this study. Here we are with a population that keeps booming and keeps demanding more meat, and both subjects are pretty well taboo from politicians who want to get elected. As far as I know, there isn't a zero population veggie promoting leader anywhere on the planet. How can we get a few billion people to take off the blinders and see where this food train is headed?
I have no idea. I guess we are, you know, adding more and more information, more and more voices. I've been really surprised at the reactions to this paper and how much publicity and attention it received. So that got me a little bit more optimistic than I was before. But of course, you never know what people take from it and, you know, in which way we're not only convincing the ones that are already convinced anyway. But yeah, I think we do need, you know, a quick wake up, and we do need some policy leadership into this. And I think it should tie with nutrition, sort of improving nutrition and improving diets, because that's another quite disastrous trend on how much we have, how much obesity we have and related diseases, and how much that's costing our society, really. So those two are actually linked, these two issues. I find that quite interesting.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time together, but I'd like to quickly ask you about another paper you published with Keith S. Richards. The title is The Positive Feedback Loop Between the Impacts of Climate Change and Agricultural Expansion and Relocation. Some of my listeners are tracking positive feedback loops, and they may not be aware of this one. Can you explain what that loop is?
Oh, I've seen you've done your homework. Yes, it's basically, if you think back a little bit when I've mentioned that yields are very important for these future scenarios. And we also know that climate change might impact on yields in different ways in different places. So in some places it might increase them, in some places it might decrease them. But overall, actually, the decreasing drivers will prevail a little bit. So by 2050, the impacts of climate change on agriculture are going to be slightly negative. What that means in my modeling framework is that we're going to need even more land, agricultural land expansion to replace that food production which we lost due to climate change. And because we're expanding land, we are then causing more climate change through deforestation, or we're causing more greenhouse gas emissions through use of more fertilizer to try and replace that lost yield from climate change. So it all becomes a little loop. I mean, it's not a huge loop that would just propel itself into, you know, a massive problem. But it does still add a little bit of consideration on top of what we're already worried about anyway.
Have the models and reports used by the IPCC fully included those sort of feedbacks and the paper that you've just done about the impacts, the carbon impacts of expanding agriculture?
They have included some of the really big feedback loops. I don't believe they've included this one yet, but these models are improving all the time, so they might include it in the next sort of iteration of the modeling work.
We've been talking about running out of carbon options if we want to keep our current agriculture and food system. Our guest is from the Department of Engineering at the University of Cambridge, UK. The paper published at the end of August 2014 is titled Importance of Food Demand Management for Climate Mitigation. That's in the journal Nature Climate Change. Boyana Bajel, thank you so much for sharing this look into our food future.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much for your listening and for your attention.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In a warming world, we picture sea level rise creeping up very slowly, measured in inches or millimeters. Maybe not. According to new science, at the end of the last five ice ages, the seas rose several meters per century, more than 10 feet. Elko Rowling is a professor of ocean and climate change at the University of Southampton in Australia. He's the co-author of the paper, Sea Level Variability Over Five Glacial Cycles, that was just published in the journal Nature Communications. Dr. Rowling, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Good, good. Why did you take on this study?
It's the sort of work that we have been engaged in for almost two decades now. So one of the things what it drives it is curiosity, is about what has been happening in our natural past before man started to interfere with climate, and you know, to get a context of what has been changing in a natural sense.
Okay, now I understand how we could measure sea level rise in past ages, but how can we know how fast it happened, right down to a century time period, which is rather short in geological time?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So what we need for that is we need continuous records of sea level change in a high time resolution. And we developed that with a new methodology of using past salinity changes in the Red Sea. And what we recently then added to that is a very strong time control to that. So we have a highly resolved record with a very good time control. And that's when we can start to look at rates of change.
How do the Asian monsoons fit into that research?
The Asian monsoons have been affecting the regional climate, and that regional climate is in that sector is recorded in cave sediments, and these cave deposits and stalagmites, they can be really accurately dated with the uranium series radioactive decay. And that really accurate dating of these climate time series we could transfer to the Red Sea sea level record that we derived from the Red Sea seafloor sediments. And in that way, we could derive a very good chronology or timescale for the sea level changes.
Can you talk us through one case that you studied? What was Earth like then and what happened?
Well, one of the most studied cases for sea level change at the last ice age is around about 14,600 years ago. Sea level made a jump, and that jump has been dated with fossil corals in other methods to about 4.5 meters per century. But what we can now do with this new method is we can look at other ends of ice ages, at the ends of 5 ice ages. So first thing, we corroborate that estimate from the corals for the last deglaciation, but we can now also find it for other deglaciations. And we find basically numbers that are very similar, especially for an event that was of the order of about 240,000 years ago and 330,000 years ago. Those two events were very similar, of the order of 4 to 5 meters per century.
4 to 5 meters, that's over 16 feet for our American listeners. Now, we should stress that sea level rise comes from land-based ice and not the more well-known melting of the sea ice cover on the ocean at the North Pole. Where is land ice melting now?
Well, land ice today is melting in the Greenland ice sheet, and especially the West Antarctic ice sheet and the Antarctic Peninsula. At the moment, the East Antarctic ice sheet is only contributing very little mass in terms of its loss, but that there is a potential there for that to speed up quite a bit as well. But we have to bear in mind that these very high rates, they are at the ends of ice ages. So we're basically talking about periods when there was almost three times as much ice on the planet as there is now, because there was a really large ice sheet, larger than the modern Antarctic ice sheet on North America. And there was an equally very large ice sheet on Europe of the size of, you know, several times the Greenland ice sheet. So there was a lot more ice, and as a result, you would expect, and that's what we now find, a lot more melt contribution. And that is what we found in our research, is that we have about 120 sea level rise events where they are smaller, but they are happening also at times when there was less ice on the planet. These rates are actually for the future more important. They are smaller rates. Yeah, so I guess maybe if we want to look at the future, we should look at those smaller rates that happen in between these large deglaciations.
Right. So because we're starting out with less ice than, you know, the whole of North America is not covered with ice as much of it was, I guess we are not looking at that worst-case scenario of a 5 meter per century sea level rise. Am I right on that?
Exactly. So what we now have is, you know, in time to when we had two times the amount of ice of today or less, the rates that we find were below 2 meters per century. And when we are constraining it further down to times when there was about the same amount of ice as today on the planet, the rates are between 1 and 1.5 at most meters per century. So we're looking at smaller but still quite large rates.
Yes, it would have a huge effect on the world's ports and major cities if sea level even went up 1 meter when you add the storm surge and things like that.
Exactly.
Now, once this process of ice melt starts, does it look to be irreversible?
It's what we're beginning to find is when we start seeing signals of ice reduction. So every time we see sea level starts to go up in our record, then in about 68% of the rises, and we're talking about 120 cases that we studied, so statistically a good number, In 68% of those cases, it's about 400 years of rise until we hit the maximum rate. So, and in about 85% of the cases, it's 600 years. So what we're beginning to see is that once the ice begins to reduce, once you start seeing that reduction really going, until you get the peak rates of reduction is hundreds of years. So that would suggest that situation could well be irreversible because it takes so long for these large ice sheets to start responding. And as a result, once they are responding, it's like a freight train. It takes long to start moving, and then it also takes long to stop when you hit the brakes full.
I'm really stunned by what you're saying. Are you saying that we're imposing a constantly rising sea and ever-changing coastline on all the humans and animals and plants to come for hundreds of years?
Well, I'm not saying we are imposing, but what I am saying is that to me, the signal is very much like this, is that, you know, where warming of the planet is potentially irreversible, if we reverse the CO2 emissions, we may have already committed ourselves to several hundreds of years of sea level rise simply by what has started to work over the last 100 to 150 years.
Professor Elko Rowling, it's my understanding that the past transitions from an icy world to a warmer one developed over very long periods, perhaps stimulated by relatively slight changes in the Earth's orbit. Can we really compare those slower changes to what might happen as we change the whole atmosphere with our greenhouse gases?
Yeah, that's the big, you know, that's the elephant in the room, really. The big question is whether the natural changes were really slow. I mean, the orbital changes, the Earth-Sun system, those orbital changes are very slow, but those are really only the trigger. And what we see happening is that as soon as we trigger a deglaciation with the orbital changes, most of the deglaciation is actually carried out by a feedback between temperature and CO2 and other greenhouse gases like methane. Now, currently, we are raising the CO2 concentration, the greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere by our anthropogenic actions, maybe 100 or more times faster than those natural feedback processes. The only thing you have to worry with sea level is whether the ice sheets could actually follow that quickly. Maybe they are too slow. They are what we would call rate limited. If they are rate limited, then we could force the atmosphere as fast as we like, but we might not be able to get the ice to respond faster than it is possible. Now, that's a big discussion. We don't know if there is a rate limitation or not. There's quite a lot of discussion about that. So what we are coming up with numbers are for natural responses to the current CO2 forcing, and it could actually be worse if, you know, our fast forcing has a worse effect. But, that's really for us to keep on monitoring. If we look at the way that the sea level rise currently is happening, it's quite slow, you would say, with about 3 millimeters per year, but it projects to quite a high number, to about a meter by 2100, because it is the early phase of the acceleration of the ice sheets that we are looking at, together with thermal expansion and some other effects.
Your paper talks about meltwater pulse. What is that?
A meltwater pulse is really when we are in a deglaciation, so basically we are in a fast phase of ice reduction. Sometimes there are pulses in those where we see a peak reduction of the ice sheets, and that is the current thought is that we are looking at some sort of dynamic process that actually allows the ice streams to accelerate to a maximum rate towards the ocean where they calve off. And so that would then give you your maximum rate of rise in a deglaciation period. So the deglaciation period overall could be 10,000 years long, but in the last deglaciation, for example, you had a 400-year period with about 4.5 meters per century rise inside that long period. So it's really a short maximum event within a longer deglaciation. And what we are finding is that all of these have rates of the order of meters per century.
Now, I'd like you to relate what this paper says and what your current research is compared to the current round of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Does your paper go with the estimates that have been published so far? Will they have to be revised?
What we're basically seeing is that past deglaciation events are actually quite coherent with the most recent one, which was already quite well known from fossil corals research. So in a sense, our values are nothing new to the IPCC because they had already one value like that that they are taking into account. The only thing is what they didn't have is an estimate of these deglaciation rates that had to do with times of ice sheets smaller than present. So basically, the IPCC has been very much looking at what is the maximum amount we could get off the ice sheets, such as the last interglacial period, about 125,000 years when sea level went somewhere between 6 and 9 meters above the present. That was more like the magnitude of rise. What we are now beginning to see is that we could put a likely number on the naturally possible rate of rise for such an event of the order of 1 to 1.5 meters per century.
Tell us about the number of scientists and the amount of time it takes to assemble this record of sea level changes for the past 500,000 years.
One would have to measure that in a period of, we started this sort of work around about 2000, and so we're talking about 14 years, and there would have been, on average, I would say 3 persons working on it every year. So we're talking about something like 14 times 3 man years of work, 42 man years of work. You know, it's not always full-time just on this. There are other offshoots as well, but that's the sort of effort that goes into it, yeah.
Now, is it possible, Professor Rowling, to go back even further looking for evidence of a large, rapid sea level change that could teach us what we could expect with human-induced climate change? Can we go back millions of years?
Well, we've recently started to divert our attentions from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, where the signal-to-noise ratio is worse, so we don't get very accurate records like we do in the Red Sea, but we can go back to 5.3 million years ago. But you have to bear in mind that what we are losing there is the finesse to the method where we can actually start to get really good rates of rise. I mean, we could get, you know, average rates of rise over a couple of thousand years or so, but we don't really get that time control or the actual signal-to-noise ratio to really start talking about these meters per century values. So I think that's a very long time away that we can do that on older records than 500,000.
As we finish up, is there more exciting science coming up that can help us further understand this process of a climate shift?
Yeah, what we're beginning to do now is what we found in the Red Sea early on in about 2007, 2008 is that in the last interglacial, there potentially have been a couple of fluctuations of the sea level rise above 0 meters or above the present. So when the sea level of the last interglacial went up to between 6 and 9 meters above the present, it seems to have been doing that in stops and starts and actually reversed for a time as well and then went up again. And that's what we're currently beginning to look at with some new techniques to see if we can refine that and firm that up, and especially if we can actually find corroborating evidence from other areas for that fluctuation. If we can, then we can start to look at rates of rise in detail above the present rate. So that would be directly relevant to deglaciating from the current condition to sea level several meters higher. And what we're beginning to see is that the rates that were involved with that were, again, of the order of 1 to 1.5 meters per century. Now, if that bears out, then that really starts to support our case that these rates may well be relevant to the future as well.
We've been talking about the latest sea level science with Dr. Elko Rowling. He's a professor of ocean and climate change at the University of Southampton and Australian National University. His latest paper, Sea Level Variability Over Five Glacial Cycles, was published September 25th, 2014, in the journal Nature Communications. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, that was my pleasure. I mean, it's always good to try and sort of convey this information to the wider audience rather than just in the technical journals. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. Humans seem set to trigger a climate change at amazing speed. We could experience a greenhouse world from just 150 years of fossil-fueled civilization. It may be one of the most rapid world-scale changes in nature's past. We're going to journey back millions of years to explore the fastest mass extinction event that we know very much about. Maybe we'll learn something about our future. Our tour guide is Dr. Benjamin Blonder from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. Benjamin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Before we get to the big meteor strike 66 million years ago, can you tell us about the state of the climate before it hit?
Sure. The climate at the end of the Cretaceous, before we saw the meteorite impact that ended the dinosaurs, that climate was actually very variable. In the few hundreds of thousands of years before the end of the Cretaceous, we saw a rapid shift from a fairly warm climate to a much cooler climate, and the cooler climate which then persisted into the early Paleogene, which is the period after the Cretaceous.
Was the Earth capped by two ice-covered poles at that time, say 70 or 80 million years ago?
You know, I'd actually have to go back and check. I'm not sure I know the answer to that one off the top of my head. I would speculate the answer is yes, but we could certainly look it up for you.
Okay, we'll check it out. Now, what kinds of plants dominated that world before the meteor came?
Sure. So we saw a variety of different sorts of landscapes. And, you know, I think one of the things people often don't fully appreciate when we talk about the Earth in the past is that the past Earth was not a completely homogeneous environment. There were many different sorts of ecosystems, many different landscapes, mountains, valleys, rivers, just as we have today. Overall, though, what I can tell you is that in the temperate landscapes that our study was based on, we were seeing a lot of forests which were dominated by primarily evergreen flowering plants. So these are not necessarily things like pines or spruces, which are not flowering plants, but more like what you might imagine in terms of today's modern analogs of hollies or ivies or rhododendrons.
That's hard to picture, you know, just what the landscape would look like. I mean, so they weren't tall tree forests, but they were densely packed with these flowering evergreens. The leaves stayed green right through the year.
Well, we actually do have evidence for trees and fairly tall trees. We have very large fossilized remains. But the species that comprise these forests, these would have been forests that would be very alien to the modern eye. And I think that's actually one of the most interesting things about this rapid ecological change. We have evidence that the Earth's past was completely different from what we're used to seeing today. There are no analogs.
Hmm. Well, how do we know what plant life was like back then?
Well, we're lucky in that we've had several very good paleobiologists go out to different parts of the world and go quarrying for leaf fossils. So what we're able to do now is look through fossilized remains of leaves, of stems, of pieces of wood, of pollen, and from these records we're able to directly infer what sort of species populated the world in the deep past.
You know, I remember interviewing Dr. Robert Spicer from the UK back in 2008, and he was talking to me about how you could tell so much from the leaf structure about the ecology of the plant and just how the plant used its energy. And I found that very interesting. Did you use a similar method?
Yes. The study that we just published was completely based on analyzing the properties of fossilized leaves. It turns out there is an incredible amount you can learn about the functioning of a plant and the environment it lives on simply by its form. Just by looking at the shape of something, you can learn a lot about how it works. So I'll give you a few examples of things that have been done with fossilized leaves before, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about what we were able to do in this study. So one of the most well-known patterns having to do with leaves is that the presence of teeth on a leaf tells you a lot about the climate in which a plant grows. if you were to go and grab a random sample of leaves from a cold forest, maybe from the boreal zone, you'd find that those species would have leaves with a lot of teeth, lots of pointed bits on the end. Whereas if you were to go to a more tropical forest, somewhere much warmer, you would instead find many leaves which didn't have any teeth at all, with very rounded margins. So for almost a century now, scientists have been using the fraction of species with teeth on their leaves as an index of warmth for paleoclimates. And one of the main ways that we infer how warm the climate was in the past is by looking at fossil leaf assemblages. So that's one thing that people have done before. The second thing that has been quite common is looking at the size of leaves. And it turns out that the bigger leaves are, the wetter environments tend to be. And you can imagine this quite reasonably. You think of a desert, you think of a very cold place, and these are environments that tend to have very small leaves. But you go to some very moist tropical rainforest, and you can easily imagine big palm leaves, big heliconias, big bananas. So there's a very strong relationship between precipitation and leaf size. The trouble with these patterns, though, is that although they're very strong, we have very little idea why they exist. There are a couple possible explanations for the relationship between leaf teeth and leaf size with climate, but they don't always work for all species. So it becomes slightly problematic to use these as indices of climate because we're not sure that the same reasons why these patterns hold today would also have held in the past.
Okay, now you're the lead author of a new paper published in the open journal PLOS Biology, and the title is Plant Ecological Strategies Shift Across the Cretaceous-Paleogene Boundary, and that means we have some explaining to do. Could you orient us to the time that you studied and what the Cretaceous-Paleogene Boundary is?
Sure. So we see a dramatic transition in Earth history at about 66 million years ago from the end of the Cretaceous to the beginning of the Paleogene. These are just names for different geological periods of time. And there's an event which marks this boundary. It's seen in a variety of different lines of evidence. The most striking is a lay of iridium, which we see in many sedimentary deposits from the period. And iridium is an element which primarily comes from extraplanetary sources, so it's very indicative of a meteorite impact. So probably something very interesting happened at this period of time. The second thing we see is that almost concurrent with that iridium layer, we see that many species suddenly went extinct. Pretty much all of the non-avian dinosaurs, many marine species, and also more than half of land plants. So this is a very dramatic time in the Earth's past. The study that we did takes a look at some leaf fossils that span about 2 million years across this interval, about 1.5 million years before the boundary and about 800,000 years afterwards.
So what happened? What hit the Earth and where?
Well, the precise impact remains slightly controversial, but the majority of the scientific community tends to think that a large meteor struck the Earth somewhere in what's now near the Gulf of Mexico and created widespread devastation and destruction, probably large tsunamis, potentially the entire atmosphere catching on fire, certainly a huge amount of dust thrown up into the atmosphere, and long-term consequences in terms of what species could persist in these new conditions. When you have a really big object like that hit the Earth, one thing that's very likely to happen is an impact winter. And what that means is the sun gets blotted out because there's so much dust thrown up into the air. And the end result of that is global cooling and very variable and shifting climates compared to what organisms would have experienced beforehand. So these new climatic conditions after this meteorite impact, which probably would have lasted for at least 10 or 20 years and potentially up to a few thousand, created very different environments. So our study was oriented in understanding what really was the consequence of that impact, especially for plants.
So the sky basically went dark with dust for we don't know how many years.
Yes, and even after that dust was gone, we still have long-term shifts in climate because of other shifts in hydrological cycles in terms of the species, which went extinct and the new ones on landscapes, new erosional patterns, etc.
I think it's interesting that you could compare it to a nuclear winter. And I saw in the press release that this thing is thought to have exploded with a force of 100 teratons of TNT.
Certainly the scope of it is much larger than anything humankind has managed to produce so far.
You've talked a little bit about the evergreen plants that were here on Earth. Why were they so successful before the comet and then not after?
Well, we're talking about a meteorite, which is right. Very different than a comet. So this is going to be a rocky body rather than an icy body striking the Earth. So then to get back to your question, what's so great about being an evergreen plant beforehand and what's so good about being a deciduous plant afterwards? So this gets us into an understanding of how plants use resources like carbon and water. And it also gets us into different things that you can measure from a fossilized leaf. So I need to talk a little bit about how plants use carbon. When you imagine a plant is growing and eventually will reproduce if it's in any way successful. And that growth requires energy. So that energy primarily comes through photosynthesis, which is energy acquired from the sun. And that photosynthesis occurs in leaves. So a leaf is essentially an energy gathering organ for a plant. You might imagine that having a leaf on all year long, like an evergreen plant, is a great idea because whenever there's sunlight and appropriate moisture conditions, photosynthesis can occur and the plant can grow. But it's not so simple. And the reason it's not so simple is that plants also have respiratory costs or active metabolism. So just as you use energy every single moment of the day and you have to eat to maintain your metabolism, so do plants. And leaves in particular represent a big metabolic and respiratory cost to a plant. So if there are parts of the year when a leaf is costing energy to maintain, but not returning any resources through photosynthesis, then that leaf is no longer beneficial, and it might make more sense to drop it. And that is, a plant species would become deciduous instead of evergreen. So how does that fit into the meteorite impact? Well, you could imagine that if there was a impact winter and subsequent very cold and dark conditions that might even be very variable, there would be quite a lot of species that were previously used to having leaves on all year round, which suddenly found themselves with big costs, not producing any benefits. So you could imagine that these species taking this particular growth strategy would suddenly become much less competitive with those that could drop their leaves and not suffer these metabolic costs during the bad times of the year. So this hypothesis proposed by Jack Wolf says that in the aftermath of an impact winter, we should see the loss of many evergreen species and their replacement by deciduous ones that could better exploit these very changeable conditions.
That makes sense. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with scientist Benjamin Blonder from the University of Arizona. Now, your paper suggests there were four possible reactions by the existing plant world, and I'd like to spend a little time on that because I think some of the same problems may be faced by plants if we cause an extreme climate shift now. So you had several things that you suggested. They might shift in space. Some may not be able to survive, or there could be new space opening up for evolution or invasive species. What did your research find were the pathways, and how did that work out for the plant world?
So what we found in this study was that species that took this evergreen growth strategy were replaced by species taking a more deciduous growth strategy. And an interesting thing there is that that strategy shift is paralleled in a change in the performance of these species from being very slow-growing to being very fast-growing. That makes sense because you could imagine a species that has leaves on all year round can get enough carbon for growth and maintenance with slow growth, whereas one that has to drop its leaves for some fraction of the year needs to grow faster for the rest of the time. So we saw this very dramatic shift. Now, is this an evolutionary shift in the sense that species that already existed changed their performance and became different in the future? Probably not. What we think actually happened in this case was that some species that were already there went extinct, and then other species, which were either already in the landscape or existed in other places, suddenly came in and colonized and immigrated. So this is not necessarily an evolutionary shift so much as an ecological shift. Now, that being said, I'm not quite sure how relevant these conclusions will be for today's systems. And the reason for that is that when we think about this paleoecological shift, we're talking about fast timescales, but ones that we're not really able to resolve with fossil data. Why is that? Well, when we look at fossils, in order to date them, we don't have that many options available in the deep past. What we do is we take points in time where we know what the date was, for example, when the meteorite hit, or other periods in time when we have evidence from other geological processes where we know an exact time. And then we have to guess what everything in between was, based on whether it was closer to one of the events or closer to the other in the stratigraphic column of rocks. So when we do that, we end up with some approximate dates for all of our different fossils and all of the different changes we see. And the uncertainty we get on that is something around 10 to 50,000 years. So let me say that again. It's about 10,000 years at minimum of uncertainty in time. So the shifts we're seeing are certainly fast, but they're difficult to resolve into the sorts of timescales that are relevant for the problems that we're seeing today.
Yeah, that's a real problem. You know, it's amazing. It's fall as we talk, and people in the temperate zones are looking out. They're seeing all kinds of colors in the trees. And that is because of this meteorite 66 million years ago, according to your research.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's incredible to look at today's landscapes and realize that they're actually probably artifacts of very long ago changes and past catastrophes.
And you also talk about fast-growing plants almost producing cheap carbon and throwaway leaves. And I wonder if that isn't the type of plant that may thrive in a world plagued by extreme weather events. But anyway, talk to us about your comparison to investing in stocks or bonds as the plant world goes.
Sure. So when we think about how plants grow, we need to think about whether they're fast-growing or slow-growing, as I just mentioned, because those are good indices of whether or not these are going to be deciduous species or evergreen species. So it turns out that in the world of plants, there are only so many ways to grow. You might imagine that as a plant, it would be great to have a leaf that has very low construction costs, doesn't cost very much in active maintenance energy for its metabolism, but then returns resources very quickly. So this would be like the sort of stock market investment that everybody hopes to find, something that's cheap and returns a huge amount of resources. Well, just as it doesn't exist for the stock market, it also doesn't exist for plants. What we actually see is just a one-dimensional trade-off between things that grow very slowly and cost a lot to build. So that's like the slow and safe strategy, primarily associated with evergreen plants, all the way over to the fast-growing cheap strategy, which are going to be leaves that have very little investment from the plant, but then return resources quickly and also die quickly. So that's like the live fast and die young approach to investing. So this overall pattern is called the worldwide leaf economic spectrum, and it controls the resource fluxes in pretty much all terrestrial plants. What we know is that it exists today across all of the vascular plant species we see now, and it seems to be the case that it's also around in the past here at the end of the Cretaceous. So there are only so many ways to live, and what we found in our study was that slow gets replaced by fast.
Benjamin Blonder, are current plants also being fossilized? Maybe so intelligent life billions of years from now could see what happened in these days?
Absolutely. Leaf fossils are forming all the time, but the process is very slow. Most of the ones we looked at in our study come from river channels or lake beds, places where leaves can be preserved in an environment that doesn't have too much decomposition, where they can very slowly have their organic materials replaced by inorganic materials and become rocks. So yes, fossils are certainly forming today, but the process is slow, and I think we'll have to wait a long time for someone in the future to understand what's happening today through fossils.
I have a correspondent, Dr. Andrew Glickson, in Australia. He's a geologist. He made a map and catalog of all the known meteor strikes during the last billion years or so of Earth's history, and things do arrive from time to time, as you said. Is there anything stopping another big meteorite showing up and hitting the Earth again?
Absolutely not. There are plenty of objects out in space, and some of them may be on a course for the Earth. What I can tell you is that my university, University of Arizona, is actually one of the world's leaders in searching for these objects in space that may be on a course to hit the Earth. We found several hundred thousand so far, and we think that's most of them, especially the big ones, but of course you can never be sure. So the Earth may have many surprises in for it in the near future.
Well, personally, I don't worry about rocks from space. For me, the most dangerous thing around here is a species that can't live up to its name, Homo sapiens. But now that you've studied this meteor strike, do you worry about another one coming?
You know, I think it's the sort of thing where if it comes, we're in for it, and we're probably not likely to do much about it. So I don't stay up at night worrying about this sort of thing. If it comes for us, that'll be that, and it'll certainly change the planet, and we probably won't be around to talk about it on the radio afterwards.
So true. I'll put a link to this article in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. The title is Plant Ecological Strategies Shift Across the Cretaceous-Paleogene Boundary. The journal PLOS Biology is open to the public. Anyone can read the full paper. Dr. Benjamin Blonder, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. That's our program for this week. Find all the links in the weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Download all our past programs as free MP3 files at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening. And please share the news about Radio EcoShock on social media.